Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 760, June the 30th, 1986. I'm still in a state of shock after learning and sharing with you last week the information that William Graham, the former acting director of NASA at the time of the Challenger, went down, has been promoted to a dual role with Ronald Reagan for, one, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and the other, science advisor to the president. So there's a lot of evidence and material that I'll share with you next week, not this time. I don't want to interrupt too much on the Challenger, this program, that it was this William Graham who suggested to the president in early January, that he should use in his State of the Union message, January 27th in the evening, that Krista McAuliffe, the teacher in space, would be up there, and they would synchronize the State of the Union message with the shuttle space program. And it was William Graham who wrote the speech that Ronald Reagan was to give, and he's been promoted in the White House. He's the gentleman who was the acting director of NASA who did not even watch the launch take off. He was in the halls or room with a particular congressman from New Mexico, and he had prepared that evening's speech for the President of the United States, and he is, as I say, going to be in charge of biology and the science parts of our country under the protective wing of the president. The two of them have so much on each other that it's really important that he got moved into this White House position. Now, an article came out of New Times Magazine, that's similar to Time Magazine, from the Soviet Union, finally writing a section on the nuclear plant in Germany that was leaking while they were blaming the Soviet Union for all of the nuclear material that was flying over Europe and around the world. The article is called Shifting the Blame, written by Mr. Tolpigin from the Soviet Union. Late last month, a group of reporters were invited to visit the atomic power plant in Hamm, North Rhine-Westphalia. They were to write about the reactor, then doing a trial run, which, according to the plant's management, included or precludes the risk of environmental radioactive contamination, even the incredible contingency of a series of errors provoking an accident. It's interesting that they had a contingency of provocation that they wouldn't leak, and I believe that the Chernobyl was a provocateur situation that the Soviet Union did not have a contingency for. The article goes on, the news stories were intended to back up the arrogant and totally unsubstantiated claims by authorities that West Germany's atomic plants are the world's most reliable. However, nothing came of it. The reporters were to visit the station on May 31st, but the day before, a spokesman for the Freiburg Institute of Ecology announced that on May 4th, a heightened level of radioactivity had been recorded in the soil in the neighborhood of the plant, probably due to an accident there, yet to all inquiries from the Institute, the plant's management said everything was in hand. That's the May 4th date that I had cited. It later transpired that an accident had indeed occurred, causing a radioactive outburst. However, the owners of the firm that operates the Hamm reactor attempted a cover-up by ascribing the radioactivity to Chernobyl. On May the 12th, they declared in a letter to the Landtag, that must be an office of radioactivity and so forth, it said the radioactivity recorded in the vicinity of the reactor is due exclusively to the accident at Chernobyl atomic plant. Chiefly responsible were the extraordinarily adverse meteorological conditions, especially the heavy rain. All rumors that reactor damage is to blame for the heightened radioactivity are completely unfounded, the rumors that Germany would do it. In mid-May, a group of Landtag deputies from the Free Democratic Party visited the Hamm plant. The Chernobyl plant went off on May the 26th, was discovered in Sweden May the 28th, and this is the follow-up, April the 26th to April 28th, and then May the 4th is when the German plant was leading the radioactivity out of that area, and it was not the Chernobyl plant, and it was on shortwave radio at this time, but covered up. The article goes on, in mid-May, a group of Landtag deputies for the Free Democratic Party visited the Hamm plant. As I said, they were not told anything about the accident either when they visited. This is while shortwave Moscow is telling everybody around the world. On the contrary, they were shown a publicity trailer that promoted the advantages of this type of reactor, the brainchild of a West German engineer. What we are dealing with is a deliberate deception of both Parliament and public, which also implicates officials of the Lands Ministry of Economics, whom the plant management notified of the accident, though, and it is true, after some delay. They waited and didn't tell them about their accident, the very thing that the Soviet Union was accused of. Only after the whole affair had come to light and local peasants and environmentalists demonstrated outside the plant was a commission set up to institute an inquiry. The heads of the power firm and officials of the economics ministry did not organize the exercise to cover up their own negligence alone. That isn't why they did it. Any news of a radioactive leak from the Ham plant would have jarred with the anti-Soviet campaign mounted in the Federal Republic of Germany over the Chernobyl accident. The independent capitalist press and both official and quasi-official bulletins were had fabrications. They both featured fabrications, noting the unreliability of Soviet atomic plants and the merits of Western, especially German, technology. The tune for this unseemingly campaign was set by the leaders of the government coalition. In quotes, the Chernobyl reactor would never have been granted permission to operate in the Federal Republic, end quote, Chancellor Helmut Kohl told the Bundestag on May 14th, to the applause of like-minded deputies who have very hazy notions of nuclear power engineering. He said he was unhappy with the information blockade that the Soviet Union had supposedly erected around the events at Chernobyl, and it should be noted that it was said afterwards that the West German government had been officially notified of the Chernobyl accident after Hans Bleek's director general of the International Atomic Energy visited the site, and many news conferences were held in Moscow. Spokesmen for the ruling parties conducted themselves in quite a different manner when the Ham accident took place, and it was debated in the Bundestag in response to a demand from the Greens party. And once again, the Greens were active on this, just as they were the ones that opened up the advanced genetic sciences and their plans to use the live bacteria in Monterey County. The article concludes, no one of them spoke of an information blockade when it came to their side or a desire to keep everything under the wraps, which they did against the Soviet Union. On the contrary, they took up cudgels for the management of the Ham plant and accused the opposition of fanning a panic by pressing for a full inquiry. Social Democrat Hermann Heinemann, labor minister in the North Rhine-Westphalia government, called attempts to sweep the Ham accident under the carpet unprecedented and swinish. And it's interesting that if the one was set up by agent provocateurs in the Soviet Union at Chernobyl, the timing was perfect because the May 31st was the date for the Freiburg Institution of Ecology to invite people in from the world to see how German plants don't leak and the other would be leaking. The only problem was that the one they were going to demonstrate was in fact leaking. Now I'm going on to some very important matters that are taking place in the United States. We cover a lot of the major stories often, and right in our own backyards, we're not really adequately covering what is going on. And I really should be updating many, many, many deaths and murders, but I have gone on to other issues, and I want to just go through a couple of these with you. There is a book out that Edward R. Hamilton, the book dealer, has right now on sale for a small price. It's called Broken Promises. The title is, it's called Broken Promises and then dash Racism in American Sports. It's by Richard Lapchick. The subject is, what happened to the political science professor when he wanted to prevent a Davis Cup match between the United States and South Africa? The book is described as a horrifying analysis of how racism in American sports is high at all levels, from high school to professionals. It's now on sale. It's usually $14.95. It's $2.95. The book dealer's address is Falls Village, Connecticut. Zip code, hope you have a pencil when you listen to World Watches or tape it, 06031-0358, Broken Promises, Racism, and Athletics. Now, I was watching CBS Sunday Morning yesterday. I usually get up and watch that. And there was a segment on Roberta Clemente. Many of you remember him, some of you don't. He was a very active, politically aware and active black Puerto Rican baseball player, very talented, and really coming up to be one of the major baseball players in America. And this segment discussed the type of racism he was confronted with. When Clemente's plane went down in 1972, he was on a goodwill mission to help the impoverished in Nicaragua. And I believed at the time that that was a murder of Roberto Clemente, a black activist, as well as a potentially very, very prominent sports person. And he was well known, but he had could possibly break many records if he had survived. The plane went down on the way from Nicaragua in 1972. One plane that left there after the earthquake was allegedly Howard Hughes. At that point, I believe it was Vance Cooper. And Somoza was supposed to have been to the plane to see him. In return for going up the steps and down, he got an airplane from this Hughes Corporation. At the time, I was suspicious of the circumstances of the earthquake and believed it could be tested as a way to cause earthquakes. And that was a long time ago, 1972, but I was thinking about that 13, 14 years ago. Well, this week they're having a postage stamp for Roberto Clemente commemorating his death. In 1979, November 30th, 1979, the Federal Aviation was found liable for the plane crash that killed Clemente, and the federal judge had decided that the plane, he was on a McDonnell Douglas DC-7, that the pilot was not capable of flying this plane. The plane was overloaded. The co-pilot wasn't qualified, and there were problems with his Mercy flight into Nicaragua. Here's a black Puerto Rican going into Somoza's Nicaragua. He didn't make it back. And just the same week that they are issuing a postage stamp for him, two other well-known athletes on their way to becoming very, very big and already recognized as top stars, Don Rogers and Len Bias, died. Now, your newspapers are filled with stories on their deaths, and I'm not going into all the details. The front page stories right off the bat, such as Don Rogers, drugs likely caused death of NFL star, doctor says. Tells how he went to a bachelor's party, he was to be married the next day, came home at 3 a.m., woke up at 8, said, "Mom, you better get help," became comatose, and died. And the articles describe this mysterious death. And now the doctors are trying to say it was drugs, without a history of drugs. And they're trying to say not only Rogers, but Lenny Bias's death is a matter of drugs. It was unusual for their character, for their personality, but they were black men trying to make it up into the system and just about getting there. The Newsweek, Time magazine has a picture of Mr. Bias. It's titled "An Empty Dream." Len Bias dies at 22, and Newsweek, I started to say, has the lead thing, "The Mystery of a Star's Death." And the newspapers, LA Herald, and the newspapers I was reading all began with the mystery. Well, when they say it's a mystery, it's a humdinger, because usually the solution and cause of death is cited immediately. Nobody hardly uses the mystery. William Raspberry, who's a syndicated black writer, he is to the blacks what Roy Cohn is to the Jews in terms of understanding what is going on, and he plays all the games within the system, talks about the lessons of these deaths, and then said, "Shouldn't we face the painful truth that no matter how venal the supplier might be, he probably didn't force drugs on anybody?" Now, that is an outright stupidity, lie, cover-up. There are people like Lenny Bruce and Janis Joplin or John Belushi who took drugs. But if somebody wanted to kill them, you make sure that there's a poison in the drug that kills them, not the drug. The drug didn't kill them. It could be the poison. If you want to get rid of them, you can. I have a very brilliant friend, a black man, who explained to me how these things happen and why. Because if each of these men could make $1 million a year, they'd move into your neighborhood, my neighborhood, white neighborhoods, and their children would go to the same private schools. Their daughter would marry your son, or your son would marry their daughter. And in order to keep this society segregated from all the races except white Anglo-Saxon Catholics and Protestants, the way to cut off is to kill those people that are earning a lot of money, that are straight, that would move into your places, that can be killed without a trace of their being killed. And to accept the fact that the one taste of drug for a first-time person, and when each of them are getting honors and moving up in their careers the very next days, it's totally impossible to believe that they could die in the way that is stated. Now, in Texas, there's been a lot of murders that I haven't covered with you at Huntsville, and it's very important to go into some of these prison murders and what is happening. But there was a story just a few weeks ago from the Houston Post, June the 6th. A prisoner there, Ronnie Beller, was heard by inmates screaming and pleading, you know, save my life, and he's crying for his life to be saved, and there's footsteps in the cell, and then he's found that hanging in the cell, and it's not so easy to do that either in those prisons, and the investigation, the grand jury, took only a few minutes, according to the Houston Post, and decided it was indeed a suicide, and nobody was charged for having, you know, hung him up there, even though he was pleading for his life, and the other people could hear him. That was the end of him, and because he wasn't beaten, or there's no signs of being beaten, they said he commit suicide, and while he was pleading for help. There were two murders in the Oakland area, Contra Costa County, that you may or may not have gotten on the East Coast or the South or the North. I don't get the murders that come from your local area, and I don't know if you get all of them here. The Ku Klux Klan and the Nazi Party, the Aryan Nations, have been very active. That's the milieu of Ed Meese and Ronald Reagan and the powers that be in their political heyday, and a lot of that White House mafia come from this area and work there. And just this last November 1985, a young art student who was about to go to Milan, a black student, he missed the last bus at the BART station, called his roommate, and between that telephone call and Neverland, he was hung on a tree, and it was called suicide. Even though he had a brilliant career, had all of his rockers, wasn't a drug dealer, a drug taker, or anything, and he was hung on a tree. The same night he was hung, two men dressed in their clown outfits were caught with knives, stabbing two black people in the area. Now, this past week, another black woman was found nearby, near the same area where Timothy Lee was, and it was a situation where they said, we found a note, and we're handling it as a suspicious death, but there seems to be a suicide note, and so the hanging is officially, by June 28th, declared a suicide. Although there was substantial evidence for a suicide, there was no evidence for a criminal act, so it was called a suicide, and even if she wrote a note, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. The San Francisco Examiner Chronicle had an article about the San Quentin Six and the retrial of Stephen Bingham. He never was tried. He left after six people were killed in San Quentin prison, including George Jackson, the political activist. And in the process of describing the acquittal of Bingham, and I haven't done enough on this program on the San Quentin Six and that trial that's been going on to April. Since April, I don't think I've done anything. They cited the late face standard described by Eric Brazil in the San Francisco Examiner, an intense, energetic attorney whose commitment to prison reform may have killed her. She said, I am convinced that the prison is a totally lawless society. She was busy with various activists trying to help the prison system and a group of people that she had helped. One member of that group got out of prison and went to her home, and before he shot her, he had her write a confession that she betrayed George Jackson before he was killed in 1971. Well, why would a black guerrilla member of a prison gang make her, just before she dies, for all purposes she was dead and she was left paralyzed with a bullet in her spine, and then she took a trip, I believe, to Hong Kong, and she died 1 year later, far out of sight of everybody, away from here, or the Bay Area. But before she was shot and left for dead, she was forced to write a note. Well, if you're going to be killed, why write your note? In the same way, these people, if you're going to have a gun there, why write a suicide note? But the point is that there are cases where people are told at gunpoint to write notes, and then, do you have a last will to say to somebody because you're going to be dead? Well, I would leave a message for them. That wouldn't mean I had a suicide. I'm going to be murdered, and I wanted to say something, and that doesn't mean that I'm going to hang myself out of a tree or in a tree. So she was writing that she betrayed Jackson. Well, if Jackson was dead in 1971 and she was shot in 1979, why would she bother to write it? The whole point is that it is a technique used under the point of gun and then you're shot afterwards. Now, the whole result or aftermath of the Stephen Bingham entry into San Quentin, he allegedly brought in a gun that George Jackson used for an escape attempt that he put in his wig, and none of those guys had wigs in prison. They weren't even allowed to have hardly anything. A toothbrush was considered a weapon in those days, and I was very active in that time period from 1970 through 1974, going in the prisons of California and working with various prisoners. In this trial, Stephen Bingham, he was acquitted, and the newspaper article described it as the last hurrah for prison reform that was to take place. Everyone stayed out of the prison after this shootout in 1971, everyone who was going to help, until 1972 when the SLA came in from Indiana, the narcotic squad, Emily William Harris and Gary and Angela Atwood, and they went into the prison and started working with the Black Guerrilla family because they were agent provocateurs that were ready to set up the kidnapping of Patty Hearst for Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan and the California powers that be. And the people that were doing the good work in the prisons were kind of eased out at this particular time. But if Bingham is innocent, if a jury of 12 decides that he didn't bring a gun and that George Jackson had no wig, then who did the shooting and who brought the gun into the prison? Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur with the LAPD, describes it in Glasshouse tapes, the incidences and the role of the Los Angeles Police Department, and again, the California Criminal Intelligence with the supervision of Meese and Reagan going up and down the coast. So when it's not Stephen Bingham that could have brought in the gun, then the case is over now and for all. It should lead to try the state policies and open up the allegations of the police department working as agent provocateurs, but it won't. The same thing happened with the attempted killing of John Paul II. Frank Turple and Theodore Shackley and Francesco Pazzani, an Italian seizman, just like the California intelligence, and Paul Hentz of the CIA and Claire Sterling, Alexander Haig of NATO, all these officials were linked directly to the assassination attempt of the Pope, or may hopefully to kill the Pope, to blame the KGB and the Soviet Union for killing the Pope, the Polish Pope. But when it didn't work and all the evidence at the trial came to the right wing and the official authorities, then the trial is over. A second trial doesn't begin. If some are acquitted, it doesn't begin. And so the San Quentin Six story is, in a sense, over, but it isn't over because those officials are now in the White House running the country. Faye Stender was murdered. George Jackson was murdered. Popeye Jackson, who headed the United Prisoners Union, was a friend of mine. I was in his apartment 2 weeks before he was murdered. Fleeta Drumgo, one of the San Quentin Six, was murdered. John Cluchet is alive. Hugo Pinnell and Rochelle McGee are locked up in prison, and nobody is helping them with their work. And Charles Gary, one of the attorneys at the time, was working with Jim Jones and Mark Lane and was in Jonestown when 912 people were murdered and sat out there allegedly with a hairdryer fixing his hair and getting ready for press conferences. Well, so much for the California violences, but they're not just in California. They are a national policy, and these athletes are part of a national, and so locally we're getting hangings by the tree in Clans and a tip of the iceberg of the prison system. And Stephen Bingham's getting off is no great miracle. Stephen Bingham, like John DeLorean or Dan White, is white, and the jury can't have trouble with a white man doing it. If it was a black man sitting in the chair, it would have been a different story, and I'm not so sure he would have been acquitted. Even on that evidence, the others were charged with murder. So if the evidence is so slim, it locks some men up, and it separates the white man, and now he's out free on the streets. Now, if anybody has doubts on the way the system works, the CIA, the Pentagon, the National Security Agency, I'll just cite off quickly a couple of items. I've put them in my filing cabinet, 26 drawers, A to Z, of people I believe that have been murdered by this system. And the athletes, of course, fall into that category, Don Rogers and Len Bias. But I just pulled out a few articles, not to do the whole broadcast, but a few to get the idea of how this system gets away with what they do. September 17, 1975, Jack Anderson said the CIA has domestically trained assassination teams that are trained to kill without leaving clues. That isn't overseas, that's just domestically. William Stevenson, who wrote The Borman Brotherhood, not the William Stevenson of Intrepid, British-American intelligence, but the one who wrote Bormann Brotherhood, describes how the system, our system and other countries have what they call hydrocyanic acid, which causes heart failure and leaves no trace. These chemicals are many, and no matter what the autopsy, it leaves no trace. Jack Anderson in 1981 was writing an article, Assassination Games. He said the secret killers of the Central Intelligence Agency have a scenario. They carry deadly poisons. They leave no symptoms at all for the first 48 hours. Some of it they were going to put to Muammar Gaddafi, but he also described how they use them domestically inside the United States. They cause a paralysis, a coma, and then a death. Now, there's no reason to believe that the people who killed Don Rogers or Len Bias and many other people with these heart attacks, such as Adlai Stevenson, were present with them and did something to them and were foreigners in a crowd among very, very close friends. That would be too conspicuous. But as Frank Turpel and the CIA explained in various documents and books that they have a substance that you put on the shoulder of somebody and it seeps into their skin, and 2 days later they die, and there's no trace of the cause of death. Well, in these cases, you sprinkle a little cocaine in the car and spread it around, and that's so easy. Or you turn a pocket inside out and you say it's a robbery. The author of The White Hand, an article, this was printed in Penthouse a few years ago. The authors are Ernest Volkmann and John Cummings. Volkmann's written some very good books on Nazis, and I don't want to cite all of his books at this time, but he has quite a few to his credit. And he wrote in Penthouse an article called The White Hand. Now, that's a group that works violently anti-Semitic, very, very racist, part of the league that links to the Aryan nations that wants to cut the throat of every black and Jew and hang them from poles from one end of the coast to the other to kill every black in America. And he had a long article in Penthouse on The White Hand in which he states that over 1,000 CIA-trained killers have formed their own Murder Incorporated, and now the CIA is worried that this independent terror network is permanently out of control. Well, he misses the point that they're worried. The CIA looks the other way while they continue to wipe out particular people because they are as racist as the White Hand. Another way to kill people that was documented in many books, and it was described in the City News in London in 1978, is with poison darts. A particular gentleman working with Radio Free America and with the Central Intelligence Agency, many of you remember the case, was in London, and he got a shot of a poison pellet, George Markov, a prominent Bulgarian defector. But the CIA could have killed the defector to blame the Soviet Union because he was on the outside now. And he did work with the CIA and Radio Free Europe, and he got a poison dart that went into his body that was so minute. And this article from London goes on to tell about suspected bacteria and the use of bacteria against civilians, and these people are directly linked and named in along with the CIA. At the time of the Watergate hearings, E. Howard Hunt told about wanting to kill Jack Anderson or make him appear incoherent and ramble, but the method was to put poison on the steering wheel of the car and it would go through the skin, and the plan then was discarded, but this gentleman who drive their car, Don Rogers or Len Bias, and many others, all they have to do is drive a car or be in public place with press conferences, which they both were, one coming to Sacramento to get married, one just joining the Celtics and having all these awards and attention. Frank Church, who died of CIA cancer shortly after his investigations, has a press conference here. It was in the LA Times, September 1975. CIA kept poisons against orders. And this is when his congressional committee Senate was looking into poisons, and it goes into the fact that at Fort Detrick, Maryland, that allegedly Richard Nixon had told them to stop chemical and biological warfare, but they kept chemicals that caused massive number of deaths. They attacked the human nervous system. They can be spread by air, water, and other means, and they were available, and they never were thrown away, and those kind of things can be in the environment of a particular person if you don't want to have them move in your neighborhood or see your families or send their children to the colleges where you go. A Dr. Edward M. Gunn for the CIA described E. Howard Hunt and various agents coming to him and how he had medicines that could be absorbed through the skin that they're the stockpile of the CIA. April 12, 1979, I had this on a program, World Watchers, April the 6th, going back to 1979 broadcast. I don't know how the broadcast preceded the article. One of them isn't dated right. But the article is CIA studied natural causes of killing. They want to knock off key guys with cancer and heart attacks. Those were two of the things. And, of course, the heart attacks were the such that they would never be noticeable. The cancer, you wouldn't know where it started, but there wouldn't leave a trace. And we have perfected those systems of cancer and heart attacks. Dorothy Kilgallen, a newspaper reporter who went to see Jack Ruby, died right afterwards. Jack Ruby charged with killing Lee Harvey Oswald under what they described as curious circumstances. They were mysterious. The cause attributed to it was drug overdose, similar to Don Rogers and Lynn Bias, probably a woman who never had drugs of any sort. And she was murdered after things that Jack Ruby had told her and was given a drug. I'll take a 1 minute break, continue with one or two more ways to kill, and then get on to some other subjects, which are not more important because this is very, very important to study. It's happening right now, right in front of us.